Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Let's do a little fill in the blank, all right? You know you have a good job when... what? Jobs and our series Consumed, coming up from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Netflix Instant Streaming. Thousands of TV episodes and movies on your computer or mobile device instantly streamed by Netflix to save you time, money, and hassle. Free 30-day trial now at netflix.com/APM.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Wednesday, the 12th of June. Good to have you with us. And we will pick up with Consumed, our series about the consumer economy and us, in just a couple of minutes. First, though, the corporate side of the NSA story. In the past day or so, Google and Microsoft, Facebook and Twitter have all asked the government to let them be more honest about the data requests that they've gotten from the government. Secret data requests ought to be the line there, because that in itself goes a long way toward explaining where these calls for transparency were before the surveillance program became public. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour gets us going today.
So here's the problem. It's quite possible that these companies have been asking for more transparency before now, but...
we wouldn't know that. We have no way of knowing that.
That's Ginger McCall with the Electronic Privacy Information Center. We wouldn't know because these companies can't tell us if they've gotten requests under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act or not, let alone whether they've fought such requests. So one reason why they're asking for more transparency is so they can defend themselves. Bruce Schneier is a technologist and author. He says they need defending.
They're trying to convince us to trust them with our data, and at the same time, they have been betraying that trust to the government. And they're in danger of losing a lot of the respect they have from their users.
But Google and Microsoft at least have a history of being, as Microsoft has said, as transparent as legally possible. Kevin Bankston is with the Center for Democracy and Technology.
Google has already done a lot to foster more transparency when it comes to national security requests by being the first to negotiate with the Justice Department to publish statistics about how many secret national security letters they get.
Microsoft has similar transparency reports, and Twitter has routinely fought subpoenas for data. Facebook does not publish transparency reports. Whether these companies' current efforts will push the Justice Department towards more transparency depends, says Michelle Richardson with the ACLU.
It's left to be seen how much capital they're willing to spend on this issue.
But at a minimum, they can at least talk about it a little more openly. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
There is news today of the radio industry, internet radio to be precise. One of the biggest names in that business, Pandora, is buying a plain old FM station out in South Dakota. An odd business move, perhaps, on the face of it, but smart. Shannon Mullen explains.
If the FCC signs off on the sale, Pandora will be the proud owner of KXMZ, an FM station in Rapid City, South Dakota, and the internet radio giant will save about 1% of its revenue on music publishing rights. Music industry veteran Larry Miller says the company is buying the station to make a point without breaking the law.
This is the latest volley in what is likely to be a very long match.
Terrestrial radio stations and their owners pay lower royalty rates. That includes Pandora's rival Clear Channel Communications, which owns 1,200 radio stations in the U.S. It also owns the online service, iHeartRadio. Pandora says it's not fair for Clear Channel to get a better royalty rate for both. The American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers sets license fees and pays out royalties. The group's president, Paul Williams, says it's the artists who are getting the raw deal.
The purchase of this radio station was clearly a stunt, a device to find a way to not fairly pay songwriters and composers who deserve to be paid for their work.
With the business models in music broadcasting changing so quickly, there's no royalty structure yet that works for everyone's bottom line. Chris Bavitz is with Harvard Law School's Berkman Center for Internet and Society.
It's hard to imagine that we're going to get to a one-size-fits-all royalty rate for musical compositions.
Until then, Pandora is getting into the FM radio business. I'm Shannon Mullen for Marketplace.
Shares of Pandora, by the way, ticker symbol P, off about 1.5% today. The broader markets weren't quite that bad, but they were close. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Okay, back to Consumed, our series this week from the Sustainability Desk.
We want more. We want more.
Here's how to order.
Now, how much would you pay?
But you can see it's worth it.
Call now, because you're worth it, worth it, worth it.
What we're trying to get at in this thing is whether we can afford our kind of consumer behavior in the long run. What we get for all the buying we do and what it costs. It's hard, right? Because the economy doesn't really work well without us. But how much longer can it keep on working this way? Or, to use a different phrase, is our consumer economy sustainable? One answer shows up in a conversation I had at the hardware store the other day with Chad, the guy who tried to upsell me the grill yesterday, if you remember that.
How long have you been here?
I've actually been here about 2 months.
2 months. Are you working full-time?
I'm part-time.
How many hours?
Just under 30 this last
year. Do you want full-time?
I would love full-time, absolutely.
But
they don't have it.
Are you getting by on 30 hours a week?
I have a second job.
Where do you get health care benefits and all that? Do you get it anywhere?
Not right now, no.
So what do?
I don't get sick, and I don't get hurt.
I don't get sick and I don't get hurt, just in case you didn't hear it over that phone ringing there. There is actually a management phrase for that. It's called efficiency innovation, using part-time workers or fewer workers for just-in-time shifts, as they call them. The industries that are creating the most new jobs in this economy, retail and restaurants, hospitality and healthcare, are also producing the most part-time and temporary jobs. Jobs without benefits or any real sense of security. Jobs that are in turn creating a different kind of consumer. One without a way to plan for the future. Marketplace's Adrienne Hill has this profile.
My name is Vanessa Madrid.
Vanessa Madrid is 43 years old. There's a spring green sculpture above her small kitchen table. It's her art, inspired by ginkgo leaves and the broad butt of one of her friends.
Every time I look at it, it makes me smile. It's a very joyful piece, which I think most of my work is definitely joyful.
Vanessa is a college art teacher. It's part-time work, temporary work. She's an adjunct.
Once you teach at a college, you've made it. Well, on one level, yes, you have. But you may get respect, but you may not get paid.
Universities have gone the way of Walmart, hiring more and more part-timers who are a whole lot cheaper than their tenured colleagues. Today, about 6 in 10 teaching jobs are filled by temporary professors and grad students.
It's about 1:25, 1:20, and we're headed to Riverside City College.
Her job's about an hour and a half from here. Vanessa packs a cooler with her dinner in it. This semester, she's teaching 2 classes, both basic drawing, 2 days a week. They pay for her rent-controlled apartment, basic bills, a small studio. But that's about it.
Thinking about making any long-term plans, it's really impossible.
She does her laundry at her parents' house. She can't afford to travel.
I would also like to be able to, at some point, move out of my little apartment into a house. And if I keep doing what I'm doing, I will never be able to do that.
When she didn't have enough teaching work, she got a retail job and kept her fingers crossed that none of her students spotted her. Teaching without security has also made a big life decision for her.
Well, at some point I had to think about having kids, and it's not been financially feasible for me to support anybody besides myself.
Vanessa Madrid, or really anyone with part-time temporary work, can't plan, can't act, can't consume with the future in mind. And it's a group that's growing. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, nearly 8 million people who want full-time work have part-time jobs instead. Arnie Kalleberg is a sociology professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He's the author of Good Jobs, Bad Jobs. And he says precarious work got its start in the U.S. back in the 70s.
And since then, as employers sought greater flexibility, we have seen increases in temporary work, in contract work, direct hire temps, as well as temp agencies, and even non-temporary work, even regular work, has become more insecure and unstable.
Companies want workers just in time. They want people to work when they need them and only then. I spotted an ad for a part-time job at Lowe's that, quote, requires morning, afternoon, and evening availability any day of the week. And it's happening across the economy. Just in reporting this story, I talked to a phlebotomist who can't afford to live on her own, a shoe salesman who has to upsell customers to earn more hours, a zoo employee whose hours are too low to qualify for health insurance. Some of my colleagues are on contracts.
Labor avoids being a fixed cost and can be shifted around depending on the employer's needs.
But these tenuous jobs rarely meet employee needs.
It creates a lot of uncertainty and insecurity. It may lead to a situation where they don't get health insurance because they don't have enough hours. So it creates a very unstable and uncertain existence.
So charcoal, just like graphite, can be found in different hardness and softnesses.
In the classroom now, Vanessa rubs a nub of charcoal across paper.
Okay, so what's the softest?
Later, as one class finishes and another group of students shuffles in, she grabs her cooler and ducks outside.
What time did I have lunch? I had lunch about 1 o'clock, a little before. It's now 6, so yeah, I'm getting a little bit low energy, so I gotta gear up.
She eats chunks of sweet potato. She tells me a student has just emailed to drop the class. Every semester, kids stop showing up when their work schedules change. Vanessa encourages them to talk to the boss, but a lot of times they're too afraid, or the boss just says, no, we need you when we need you.
Jobs in Riverside are hard to find, so they opt for just dropping sometimes all of their classes.
Students drop out to work at the grocery store or a coffee shop, the kinds of jobs the economy's creating these days.
And some of my students, I found out, are supporting their families with their Starbucks job. So they need to keep working. That's the priority. So it's hard to it's hard to talk a student into staying when they say that.
Goodbye degree, goodbye earning potential that comes with it. A few more bites and Vanessa heads back in.
Guys, left any charcoal on the table?
Another 2.5 hours of class to go.
Guys, please check because we.
As the last students pack up, Vanessa shoves her stuff into three narrow drawers. Adjuncts don't get offices.
It's almost 9:30. So we've been here since, 2:40? Yeah.
Now headed home?
Yeah. Now headed home.
It's back to the car and to the hour and a half drive. Vanessa's lined up two jobs for this summer, teaching an art class in Riverside and working with kids for the city of Santa Monica. She'll be working 7 days a week.
It's going to be exhausting, but I don't know what's happening in the fall. I'm still looking for another college for the fall. So I have to say yes to everything that comes my way.
A lot of people with part-time work live more precariously than Vanessa. But what they all have in common is the inability to make plans for the future, to build a net, invest. At 43, Vanessa's still hopeful that she'll land that full-time job, doing what she loves, teaching, that she'll get that career, maybe buy a house and have a family.
I really like people. I really like taking care of people. I think I would have been a really great mom, and I think I'll be a really great stepmom someday.
I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
No matter what kind of job you have or want, the trick is finding the right one. We went out today on Twitter and asked you to fill in the blank that I mentioned up at the top of the broadcast. You know you have a good job when. Take a listen to some of the answers.
When I'm employed.
When you can make Facebook posts during business hours.
When you're the boss.
When there's more paycheck than month.
When your friends are jealous.
When you never look at your checking account.
Beer Friday. Nuff said.
Fill in your own. You know you have a good job when. You can tweet us at Marketplace APM. You can get me at Kai Rizdo. Coming up.
Trying to get movies made because they're good is so 2003.
Oh, so that's the problem with Hollywood. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off for a third straight day today. Dropped 126 points. The blue chips did 0.8%, ended at 14,995. The NASDAQ kept company, lost 36 points, 1%, 3,400 on the nose. The S&P 500 dropped 13 points, 0.8%. finished at 1612. You know a lot of the companies that depend on part-timers, like Adrian was talking about. Darden Restaurants, owners of Red Lobster, Olive Garden, and other chains, off 2.8% today. McDonald's shares also flat. Yum Brands, that's Taco Bell, KFC, and Pizza Hut, also flat today. Retail is another big category. Office Depot took off 2.1%. Lowe's lost 2/3%. Target off 0.8% today. And you are listening to Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Netflix Instant Streaming. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your computer, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. Streamed now by Netflix, a great value. Netflix Streaming has lots of movie and television options, including past seasons of House of Cards, Breaking Bad, and Arrested Development. Watch them using Netflix Instant Streaming and find thousands of other TV series and movies during your free 30-day trial at Netflix.com/APM.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on retail sales for May. A Senate subcommittee on transportation, housing, and urban development discusses crumbling infrastructure, focusing on outdated and overburdened highways and bridges. And the White House hosts a Pride Month reception with the LGBT community. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl, and it's time now for a little Freakonomics Radio. That moment every couple of weeks where we talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. It is all together now, the hidden side of everything. Dubner, how
everything.
Are you, man?
Everything. I'm doing great, Kai. How about you?
I'm good.
Hey, let me ask you this. If I were to ask you to name, let's say, the most influential institution mm-hmm. in society, what would you say? I'm curious.
Marketplace and American Public Media, dude. Barnett. No,
well,
I don't know.
Excellent guesses. let me suggest a different one.
All right, good.
The family.
Yes.
The family. Okay. Now, we all know that our families shape each of us. We also know that family differs a lot from culture to culture. So, a couple of economists decided to analyze how our family ties affect economic outcomes around the world. Hmm. Here's Paola Giuliano at the UCLA Anderson School of Management.
People who rely on the family tend to trust mostly the family and less the outside world. Therefore, they tend to be more inward-looking and they develop a lower level of social capital or political participation.
All right, so let me decipher here for a minute. So, people with strong family ties being more inward-looking, that I get. But, yeah. but what is mm-hmm. that, the whole lower level of social capital or political participation thing? What does that mean?
Yeah, it's interesting. So in a country like Italy, let's say, where Giuliano is from, yeah. family ties tend to be very strong, which brings a lot of good things, to be sure. You get love from your family, yep. support, trust. But relying on your family mm-hmm. will make you less likely to trust other institutions like the government and big companies. And if you want to do business, you need to trust institutions. So what her research found is that cultures that have strong family ties tend to have weaker economies.
Yeah, but what about family-run businesses, right? Are you necessarily saying that a family-run business is less profitable than a non-family business?
Actually, I am necessarily saying that. So there's a lot of research showing that a family firm, let's say where the founder hands off the reins yeah. to a relative, that firm will do worse than if they bring in an outside CEO. And I mean, just think about it for a minute. What are the odds that the best person to run my company happens to be blood related to
right,
me,
right? Right?
So that said, family business is still very common in many parts of the world, Latin America, parts of Asia, Western Europe, especially where institutions are not as strong. The U.S. actually has a pretty low incidence of family firms and seemingly getting fewer all the time. You've heard of Anheuser-Busch, I assume, yes?
Yes. They make what they like to call beer, Budweiser, and some other stuff. Yeah.
But, you know, this company was an amazing American yeah. success story yeah. for five generations of Bushes until the last one, August Bush IV, who was CEO when the company got bought out by InBev. Now, a former company executive named Bill Finney told us just how strong family ties were for the Bushes, and this included a rather peculiar custom that August the 4th participated in.
I don't think August would have become the CEO of the company, but the fact that from day one, from the hour that August was born and his father puts five drops of Budweiser in his mouth
wow.
when he's 1 hour old— he was indoctrinated into the core values and the culture of Anheuser-Busch.
All right, so that's a little weird, dude. I'm just saying.
I think that is a sensible response to that cut. Yeah, I mean, here's the really interesting takeaway for me from this research about how family ties affect broader economic outcomes. And that's this. It's a broad conclusion, which is that how much our lives are shaped by, let's say, an institution or an event that we really don't have much control over. So we like to tell ourselves, each of us, that every decision we make is our own. But to some degree, I would argue we're all accidents of history. I'll give you an example of this. Anheuser-Busch sells alcohol, which in this country is legal. Yep. Marijuana, meanwhile, is mostly still illegal. Here's my Freakonomics co-author Steve Levitt talking about that weird state and why that is.
If you think about why is it that alcohol and cigarettes are legal and marijuana is not, I think that is mostly accident. If people had been smoking marijuana regularly for the last 300 years and alcohol had just kind of come along and been on the fringes, there's no way we'd say, you know, oh, alcohol should be freely consumed by everyone all the time. So it's kind of a historical accident that you live with.
You could just see that world after 300 years of marijuana consumption, right? Whoa.
And August Bush would have had to be token a joint when he was born instead, then, I guess.
Accidents of history. Stephen Dubner, Freakonomics.com is the website. We'll see you in a couple of weeks, man.
Thanks for having me.
All right, bye-bye. Hollywood, like any other industry, hasn't been immune to the pressures of a long and grinding recession, a whole bunch of technological changes, and a new global economy. Whether you've noticed it or not, that has brought big changes to the big screen. Longtime producer Linda Obst, her movies include The Fisher King, Contact, and Sleepless in Seattle, lays out exactly what's changed in her new book. It's called Sleepless in Hollywood, Tales from the New Abnormal in the Movie Business. Linda, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you. It's so good to be here.
You're talking about the new abnormal in this book, and I have to ask you what the old abnormal was.
Well, the old abnormal was a time where we could make movies because they were good. As my son once said to me when I was trying to figure out in the midst of the transition why I couldn't get a movie made, and it just wasn't working. And he said, Mom, trying to get movies made because they're good is so 2003.
Which is just so distressing. I mean, here you guys are, this enormous industry, and what you're telling me, and the story in this book really is that the game has completely changed.
That's right. And it's not as though the moguls in charge of greenlighting movies suddenly changed their standards. It's that the business entirely changed. All of a sudden, the sales of DVDs, which had financed what we call interstitial movies, the movies between the giant winter movies and summer movies where the kids are out of school, those movies were financed by the cushion, the profit cushion of the industry. When the DVD collapse occurred, it took half of the profits of the industry away, and it could not afford to operate on this margin.
And is this why now we have to have Iron Man 3 and now this summer we're getting the first of what will be the revitalized Superman franchise, and you have to have these big whiz-bang multi-bajillion-dollar movies because Hollywood doesn't know how to make a profit and loss statement?
Yes, because what came to replace these revenues from DVDs is the international sales. Suddenly, Russia and even more so China started building more theaters and loving our big blockbusters. And they'd never seen effects like this before. You can make small movies in any country in the world, but you can't make Titanic anywhere but the United States.
There is a tendency, I think, on the viewing public's part, in which I include myself, to think of Hollywood writ large as this smoothly functioning well, you know where I'm going with this question, right? It's pandemonium out there. I don't know what you people are doing, but there are people getting hired and fired and tossed and attached and unattached.
And now,
it's amazing you guys make any money. I mean,
well, you know, as my grandmother used to say, you can't make a living. You can only get rich.
So what's the next volume of this book going to be? I mean, is there a sequel in the works where you describe the future for us?
I think the studios want to be able to make movies for the domestic audience as well. But we'll never give up being a global business. We can't go backwards. We're always marching forwards. And I think that's why technology is going to be our friend as well as it was our enemy. Technology allows a young filmmaker to make a film on his iPhone.
Right.
That's good. That mixes it up a lot. I think that movies and television are merging with watching movies on our computers, watching movies on our iPhones, watching movies everywhere. So the goal is to just keep taking swings at the bat, and then you figure out later where you're going to watch it.
Linda Obst has been in Hollywood for a while now, anyway. I hope you're
for millennium.
Saying that. Yeah, there you go. Her new book is called Sleepless in Hollywood. Linda, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, courtesy of the United States Navy. For 150 years, since the earliest days of telegrams and teletypes, the official Navy communication system only allowed for all capital letters, which, you know, makes people feel like they're being yelled at. They're rolling out a new system, accepting what the world already knows, that all caps are just really annoying. Best part, though, the official announcement was in all caps. I spent 8 years in the Navy, people. Reading those things, those caps bug me every single day. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow off 126 points, 0.8%. The NASDAQ down 36 points, 1%. The S&P 500 off 13 points, 0.8%. Carlos Asensio, Ravi Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineered the program for us. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you back here tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. Never mind.